We had a couple of questions for the panelists, but I'd really like to open it up to the audience. Is that okay with you? And I just want to make sure, Hale, do you have a question? No? Okay. So now's the time for you to ask questions. There's been a lot of information provided over here. And if you can keep your comments or questions, and this is where you get to share your opinions freely, but no more than 2 minutes, we welcome that. So why don't we start off over there, and I see Sean's hand over here, and Herb will come to you afterwards. Okay.
I guess my biggest issue with calling a wheelchair accessible lift is whether when it gets here that I'll be able to get on it. And is there any way that we could actually have a measurement or something so that it tells us that what the general size of the vehicle who's coming is, so that we know, especially for those of us who use larger wheelchairs, can know that the van that actually comes that is actually accessible, especially with these smaller vans, because I've had to press my foot pedals up, I've been pressed against the side, I've ridden sideways, I've ridden a lot of different ways on the little teeny vans. Just would be really nice to be able to get some general specs.
So yes, at least in our area, one of the things I've been able to provide to customers who ask is the dimensions of the wheelchair accessible vehicles. I'm happy to share that. So if we connect afterwards, I can email it to you, et cetera. But that'll be for Uber Wave, at least in this area.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Maybe try to get that information for 6 months.
Okay, Sean.
I was just curious about the 10-cent fee that's getting collected on the SB 1376 legislation, and has there been discussions about how that is going to be distributed, and are we looking at sort of comparable same-day wheelchair accessible transportation on demand as the TNCs are doing with their ambulatory service? And there's a second part of that question is, are we aware of any partnerships where there is any other kind of cost-sharing arrangement to bring on-demand wheelchair-accessible rides for folks?
Marilyn?
Certainly, we're trying to press hard for comparability of response times. I think, you know, those of us who've been involved in it, it's not clear yet what it's going to be. And once we get rules, it's not clear. You know, I think there may, you know, I'm concerned, I guess, that there will be some discrepancy between the theory and the practice. But it could be that the CPUC requires sufficient data that we really will be able to tell. The other person that is, you know, that has been involved in the details of this is here is Annette. I don't know if anybody else has been. All I can say for our purposes is that we've pushed hard for it, and the CPUC has not fully. And one encouraging sign is that their staff proposal really wasn't bad, and it based it looked at, you know, this program covers every county in California, and so it looked at all the different counties and it put them in categories with certain characteristics, and you know, some of the times were much longer than I'd like to see, but others were pretty short, and the major sort of urban, dense urban areas have the shortest times. Whether they're truly equivalent, the law doesn't exactly say that it has to be equivalent, but there's a lot of ways we're taking characteristics that the law does require and saying that it's in essence equivalence and that, and here's what it would mean, and making suggestions. So it's still at back and forth comments and reply comments, et cetera, stage. I have to say again, we're hopeful. Additions to that, I don't know if anybody wants to pass it to anybody who's close to the situation.
We're getting another mic, by the way. So.
One thing I can say, in terms of the benchmarks that the CPUC has put out there, they're saying, like, for instance, we'll just take San Francisco. 8 minutes is the average time of response time for the general public. And so what they're doing for the benchmarks is saying that in two tiers. So one is 8 minutes, the other is 16 minutes. And they're saying a certain percentage of trips have to be done within that timeline in order to be able to get the offset. So for instance, I think that the first one, and I can't remember off the top of my head, but like 50% of the trips have to be within 8 minutes, or 60% or 70% have to be within 16 minutes in order to get the offset in San Francisco. So what's of concern, what we want to make sure is that they're really clear benchmarks so that the TNCs have to reach a certain level in order to get to be able to keep those funds. And if they are not reaching that level, then those funds would be available to other access providers. But I think from what Marilyn was saying, and a lot of people in the disability community want to be sure that the TNCs themselves are doing the accessible service. They want to be able to go to the same app and get the same service if possible. And in dense areas, that should be possible with the money that's being raised through the, I mean, that's my opinion anyway.
But is it realistic
to really
expect them to do that? Twice the time of what the average person would get for the services that's being allowed, but is it realistic to always for them to be able to do that?
Well, I think in my estimation, if you have the funding to do it, you can do things, right? And so my thinking is, I mean, you have to see what the demand is, right? At this point, we don't know how much the demand is. But if you're able to, for the general public, make an 8 minute, why shouldn't you be able to do it for others? You know, if you had every vehicle accessible, then you could do it in 8 minutes, right? So it's all about, in my mind, about money, right? If you have enough funds that are available to do that, then you can. Obviously, it's much easier in a dense area than it would be. And the benchmarks are very different for other counties where it's not so dense. The benchmarks are much different. They're like 30 minutes, and I'm sorry I don't have the chart right in front of me, but you can get it by going, well, good luck with all the...
It's complicated.
You can ask me off.
Yeah, that's right. We will... you could argue back, and I think perhaps fairly. I mean, we don't know what... You know, what does the general public get in lower density areas of the state, if there are TNCs at all. Right. You know, they probably don't get what a non-disabled person gets in downtown San Francisco, probably longer. So that's what they would argue. So there's a lot of charts and graphs going back and forth. And we have been somewhat encouraged by the TNC's decision so far. I'm sorry, by the California Public Utility Commission's decision so far. But it's hard to know. I mean, I would certainly hope that it improves over what the, you know, Uber and Lyft's pilot, you know, sort of, is it required or is it voluntary? That is a debate. But what the programs they have so far right now are doing, we certainly hope we will see improve response times under the TNC Access for All Act. I think that we should, just like Annette says, there'll be more money. I think that, you know, the other thing is that people who've been close to paratransit operations know that, you know, how much effort it takes and how many things have to be in place to really ensure, you know, and how many factors go into, you know, good on-time service and good response times. And, you know, that, you know, some of the bigger cities have, you know, expensive high-tech systems to help, say, transit agencies monitor the contracts that they put out. And, you know, we have tried to take some of those principles and put them, you know, explain them and put them into our comments and find a way to apply them to this situation of TNC on-demand service. And sometimes it doesn't exactly fit. So, you know, and at this point, well, we also don't have a full set of regulations.
So a question of here. Michelle, I just want to let other people have an opportunity to ask, I haven't had a chance yet.
All right, so my question actually was really simple, and it's probably in the legislation. I'm just not understanding it, or I just don't know where to find it. So the test cent per trip fee that's required, when a trip is subsidized by, say, like a municipality or something like that, is that trip fee, are we still subsidizing that fee, or should there be some kind of credit? Because it just seems to me that it's sort of a diminishing 10 cents that we keep paying over and over and over again. Because it goes back into the fund, it would get claimed back by the fund for a vehicle, and then if the trip subsidized again, then it just seems like it's diminishing. So I don't know if there's any addressing.
It is my understanding that these fees are coming out of the general privately funded service available to the public that Uber and Lyft does, not when Uber and Lyft are contracted in a subsidized program. I don't know if those are being charged the fee. The general rides are being charged a fee. So you may not be continually paying in that don for each ride. I don't remember that question actually coming up in the rulemaking. My impression is that this is the general public. I don't know if Annette has a different impression. But I don't think so. I don't think riders in subsidized programs are paying that fee.
I do.
You think they are?
Yeah. We have someone, okay, someone from Lyft here. You can tell us. Is everyone paying it or not?
I believe everyone is paying it.
Yeah, I think we are. Yeah. Everybody.
Okay. So that means the good of that is that there's more money to provide wheelchair accessible people rides. You could argue that the bad of it is that you're having to keep, dime after dime paying a subsidy. Most of the organizations working on behalf of, trying to get more out of this program have felt that, the more money we can raise, it's going to be worth it in the end. But I know that I don't want to disregard the fact that, every penny really counts for a lot of low-income people with disabilities in California. We know that disability is statistically correlated with poverty, and I don't mean to dismiss the impact of those fees.
Before we go back to the audience, I wanted to ask particularly Jonathan and Tim, we had a question, I should have given you a heads up. Now, for the rest of the panelists, so for those people who are here with programs that don't have partnerships with TNCs, what are the first considerations jurisdictions and advocates should consider to plan for successful partnerships? If you want to think about that for a second. And after we've taken a few more questions, we had one last question we'll have for all of you. What is your vision for the 5 to 10 year future of mobility for seniors and people with disabilities? And how does it take TNCs into account? So I just wanted to give you a little heads up on that one. I don't want to put you on the spot if you don't have an answer, Jonathan.
You go.
Oh, I can start with that one because I had it since I was on planning. I've seen the question earlier.
Yeah, right. You had a chance to think about it.
So, in terms of what I think organizations that are starting partnerships should be thinking about, I think that they should be utilizing their riders or their other different advisors and input to really think through all the possible contingencies of what can go wrong. And to really plan all of those, brainstorm those, and plan all of those ahead of time in policy as much as possible before diving in.
Thank you.
I got an answer to the, that's why I was on my phone, everybody. I never do my phone when I'm in a meeting, but I'm like, well, I can actually get the service animal question answered. I'll just ask. So I wasn't cheating on the no phone rule. So one thing I want to point out, we have never had a service animal complaint, but that's not speaking to the general experience, because the vast majority, and I know it's over 95% of the people who qualify for MOAD qualify because they're elderly, not because they're disabled, although a number of people are both. So it speaks less to the experience of disabled people in the community and more to the fact that we just don't have that many service animals trying to get on the service, but we have yet to have a service animal complaint. He actually sent me all of the MOAD complaints we've received in the entire history of the program, and he searched for a dog, service animal, or animal, and there were no complaints at all. So that's the answer to that question. The thing that I think you need to think about going into this is about staying flexible, evolving as the program continues. FTA is changing the rules as we speak and continuing to look at how they want to measure this stuff. And definitely you have to have your, and I admit, you know, we're not fully equitable, but you have to have your equity conversations on the front end instead of after the fact. And also last thing, you need to be acceptance of some level of risk that's abnormal for public agencies. Because if you're risk averse, you can talk yourself into forget about it really fast. We had a number of people in our community who were like, what if a Lyft driver kidnaps one of our people? They could be drugged up, and you know, I was like, well, we certainly can't prevent that from happening. It could happen, and at the same time, do we want to carry a lot more people, and give a lot more people mobility, and take the risk or not? Because we just have to decide. So the risks are real, because the people are less vetted, in my opinion, but it's paid off for us because we've been able to provide mobility to a lot more people. So that's how I feel about it.
Great, thanks. So I guess the first thing is be adventurous and do something, right? I think sometimes we get so stuck in what could go wrong or what, this won't quite work right, that we don't do anything at all. And I think that what we found is that the more choice you give people, the more different programs, the more freedom and accessibility that you give someone. And no, they're not all perfect, and we all strive for that perfection and continue to improve. But don't get stuck not doing something because you're scared of it or because it doesn't quite work. The other thing I'll point out is, if you're really interested in doing the partnership, obviously I'm available, but the TNCs have experts that are public transportation people before they were TNC people that can help you out. And so if you're interested in developing a program, they see the whole picture all the way across. So talk to them. And my my experience with them has been transparent. You know, one of my favorite questions after the city of Monrovia did their TNC program, which blew up and was fantastic but cost a lot of money, is what's your budget? And then they make sure that they stay within those lines too, which I appreciate. So, ask me, ask the TNCs, ask Tim, but be adventurous and do it, because I think more choice equals more freedom.
Thanks. Marilyn, did you want to say something else?
Yeah, I do, just briefly. I agree with Naomi, first of all. I mean, we really have to anticipate what the problems can be and work out ways that the system doesn't allow them to happen, if at all possible, or minimizes them. And in terms of Richard's, you know, visionary question, I mean, it's going to take to some extent that long, you know, a few years to really know if the TNC Access for All Act is working. So all I can say is that if it doesn't do what we want, those of us who work on policy are going to try to develop, you know, something improved. But I just think that, I think I like that we have a combination of people with disabilities arguing for sort of planning all the contingencies and transit providers saying, go for adventure and be bold. That's just as it should be. You know, all these programs differ in certain ways. And you know, the work that we're involved in is really shooting for you know, wheelchair users having some, you know, equivalent service to other service. And some of these programs don't have that and some do. And we're hoping that the one that's government run, which is the one under the TNC for All Act, hits that equivalency. At least as far as any of the other programs do, because that's what its job is. I hope it will deliver that.
Thanks, Marilyn. And I'll come to the others afterwards on that question, because Herb's been waiting for a little bit.
The guy that talks too much takes a long time to wait for it. Okay, I'm basically plugging with Jonathan. The TAC Advisory Committee is very involved with the staff, and we are informed pretty much every other month of the current status of different programs. To explain about Go Dublin, the Go Dublin program is very well usable, except for Sean's issue with the wheelchairs. It's out there, but yes, it's hard to find. Overall, the fees are very manageable. For example, I live in FBAR, and it's within 2 miles of the movie theater, and it doesn't cost me $1 to go one way. And where, if I go to Pleasanton right now, it's $12. But the long goal is, and Jonathan's aware, is that I'm attempting to make it the entire valley to cover it, so that it gets all the way around. And then Dial Ride, to answer Michelle's question, the Dial Ride service covers all three cities regardless if the bus is running in the service area of the area the resident is. It covers the entire valley.
Thanks, Herb. Now, there are people, okay, Tina, I was just going to say, we'll go to Tina next, but I know there are a couple of people up here who are providers who have got some experience with TNCs. I won't put you on the spot, but if you want to speak about your experience or what you've learned, I think that would be helpful for the people in the audience. Why don't we go to Tina? Thanks.
I just wondered, are there any service area requirements for the TNCs? I know of people who live in rural areas, for example, who say, well, not only are there no wheelchair accessible TNCs, there are no TNCs of any sort. Is this something that's likely to be changed with TNC Access for All?
TNC Access for All does not require TNCs to provide wheelchair rides where they're not providing general service. It's mostly where they operate. Now, the thing is, we may know where they're operating today and not where they will be operating tomorrow. And that's why it was so important to get statewide coverage, so that when there is service in, you know, Bakersfield, Fresno, or what have you, as much as San Francisco and L.A., then the provisions of the law will be there, hopefully, to produce the wheelchair rides.
Thanks, Maran. Question at the back? Good. We haven't had any questions from the last third of the audience. So, yeah.
This question is for Tim and Jonathan. What level of data has Lyft and Uber given you in terms of origin, destination, trip purpose, any of that stuff, and have you integrated it into your planning process?
Thanks. So one of the things that we're working on and that I've worked through with the partners is NTD data and how we're going to treat this for the National Transit Database moving forward. So we get a lot of information on the average trip length, service hours, service miles. That's all been really useful. One of the things, again, we don't, trip purpose, we wouldn't, I think that's probably the realm of privacy that we don't want to dive into. But we do see heat maps. That's probably been a super helpful item for me, which is just seeing where people are and where they're going. And sometimes there's an obvious one, like BART, right? Like, we know they're going to BART. But when you see a heat map of like a certain community that doesn't have fixed route service, wow, there's a lot of uses there. There's a lot of people that want to use transit. Maybe we should put a bus route there, right? And then move it around. So It's been able to do this fine balance of coverage and productivity where a big bus makes sense, we put a big bus. Where it can't sustain a big bus, we have the TNC partnership.
Great. Did that answer your question?
Yes.
Okay. Tim was going to answer it as well.
It's evolving. One of the things I've wanted to show for a really long time is what is the peak number of vehicles that we actually need to service our community at any given moment, and what time of day is that? We're trying to work through getting that information now because I think that really, once we can nail that down, that's going to really let us know why van systems that don't have any flexibility fail. I don't know how many vehicles this is, and I really want to know because I want to be able to share that information with you all. But what we do is we feed every data need that we have to Lyft, and we slowly work through getting somewhere to, you know, whatever we can share. There are state laws controlling, you know, privacy, so that's also a factor with transit information.
Thanks. Sean, did you want to speak about your experience?
Yeah. Sure. First of all, I wanted to acknowledge Paul Davis from Lyft here. The city of Fremont, with our Ride on Tri-City program, just in November 15th launched our ride-hailing pilot project, and it's going very well, although we haven't ramped up yet in terms of hitting the streets with major publicity. But our riders have generally found that having the control and being able to book rides, you know, as Tim was mentioning, really brings another element of a sense of agency back in people's lives. The comment that, or the question that Richard had about lessons learned, I think you have to be really, as a public entity, really open to doing business differently. That is, you can't use your standard agreement. You've got to have your legal teams working through a lot of stuff for a really long time to reach agreements. But I think in the end, with the city being flexible and with us being able to launch, we have a really great opportunity here. There are certainly a lot of ups and downs with TNCs, and I'm really curious how AB5 is going to impact TNC operation in California. I think we as public entities, especially within Alameda County, really could be banding together to look more specifically at how to provide rides to people in a much more efficient, economical way. I'm really interested in this issue of service equity. One of the things that we have built with our program currently right now is looking at a set service area with set service hours of 8 to 6 with a set number of trips per month for all our services, whether it's our current wheelchair accessible van, our taxi program, or the project that we have with Lyft through the app, or the call center function that we have for the TNC rides. I really do see like we can figure out some way of doing on-demand wheelchair accessible service. I think the catch is how do you predict wheelchair accessible demand, and how do you ensure that that is an efficient and cost-effective service to run? I'm looking for additional city partners who are interested in talking more about these issues and figuring out how we can address the equity issue in a much more substantial way than we're doing currently.
Thanks, Sean.
And I'm happy to entertain or talk to folks afterwards about specifics of how we set our program up and additional information.
Great. I think we'll take one last question or comment over there, and then I'll come back to the panelists just to answer. Marilyn's already answered that question, and then we'll wrap up.
Yeah, I was curious. I know that with Lyft and Uber, there's a lot of the taxis still have the premium spots for pickup, and the problem with that is that there's not a whole lot of taxis anymore. So it's not really practical. I'm just wondering, and I don't even know on what level that would be addressed, what is being done about that? Because I was thinking for wheelchairs or for if you're at the airport, the taxi zone is right by the terminal, and the Lyft and Uber is way out someplace else. How is that being addressed, or is it being addressed?
So I'll tell you what we're doing. The airport's its own beast, I think, but in Santa Monica, I've started to research curb management and how it's changed through the ages. And apparently, when automobiles were first invented, there was no parking along any curb because it was assumed that loading and unloading would be a necessary function and not car storage for most curb. So people didn't park on curbs. They used curbs to get in and out of vehicles, and that was accepted in most cities in America for the early part of the automobile. And I think we have to go back to that. I mean, we've got Uber Eats, we've got every single thing we can possibly imagine being picked up and dropped off, and the curb is fully occupied with cars. So we're advocating to the DOT, to our Department of Transportation in LA and Santa Monica, that curb management has to get addressed, and it has to get addressed now. We have to look at the needs on a block-by-block basis, but the thing is, we've got to pull new partners in for that conversation, to the people who control the roadway, the people, the DOT. The wrong people are in the room. And we had a curb management two-day seminar in Los Angeles. Don't ever spend 2 days talking about curb management. It's the worst thing you could do. But we did it, and we came out the other end. And they were like, well, we hope you all learned a lot. I'm like, what did we learn? What happened? I don't even understand. There was no marching orders. I think it's just a really new thing, but I highly encourage anybody in this room who sees loading and unloading as an issue to start to raise it with the DOTs and around the area, because I think what it's doing to us is it's making people load and unload in bus stops. And our buses are sitting there with the blinker on, called a blinker in New England. It's a flasher here, I think you call it, right? Sitting there with the flashers on, trying to get into the bus stop, and it wastes a lot of time. So DOT, got to get them in the room. Can I just say, I want to let everybody know, the folks from Swiftly came here. If you want to pay for brand new paratransit in your area, we just saved an enormous amount of money by hiring these guys to retime our transit system. We cut $500,000 out of the time we run the buses. We had zero driver complaints, and our on-time performance is still just as good. So these guys came here today to meet people, and they walked in after the introductions were done, but they've been a tremendous benefit to us.
Great. Well, that was quite a plug. you can put your hands up if you like, just let people know. Great. So I want to end on time. So if we could just take 1 minute, the three panelists, to respond to that question about where transportation is going to be, Naomi's had a chance to think about it, 5 to 10 years from now, and will TNCs have a role in that, do you think?
Well, I think, when we look at, say, why weren't wheelchair taxis available, because of some rather odd loopholes that have been built in to policy and legislation. And same thing, the reason I was in D.C. was to do with some airline access issues. And again, there's loopholes with the ADA that don't apply to airlines. I think what I would like to see in the vision is where these loopholes are done away with, and so that any mode of transportation, if it's the TNCs that are still around, great, but that we are seeing really equitable access and not making excuses for why we can't have it on any mode for everybody.
Yeah, I think in terms of access, this conversation is becoming up in Santa Monica a lot with scooters and shared mobility devices, and that there's just nothing happening in terms of making them accessible. My own opinion is that we have shown that the automobile as a single occupant mode of travel is a failure in terms of what it does to our cities and does to ourselves. And socially, everything. And Los Angeles is leading the way in showing how destructive the automobile can be. So I think people are ready for something beyond the automobile, and I think it's going to get more and more diverse and evolving. I think we need to give a lot more space in our communities to other uses. I think we need to start trimming down the amount of space that we give to people who drive alone and start giving it back to the other people who decide to get out of their cars, whether they're disabled or not. I definitely agree with your points about access. But I think in 5 to 10 years, we're going to see a continued shift in that direction, and I think it takes everybody talking about it and acting like it matters.
Great, thanks.
So I guess I look in 5 to 10 years, how TNCs would look, et cetera, is that it has to change, right? There is not an option anymore. There has to be more share. We have to learn how to share, because the single occupancy vehicle isn't going to work anymore, period, end. Like, the commute from Livermore into the city is going to take days, not hours. And so I like the conversations that we have. I like that we're talking about accessibility now rather than when it becomes a necessity for us all to share, right? We're finding these new programs. But I really see share ride of some form, right, being the future, and it accomplishes what we need, which is that solution of the first mile to last mile. And I would challenge everybody to not just say public transit is good, but really look at, is public transit working for me? And if not, why not? And what are we going to do to change it? I can tell you for me personally, one of the things is that taking the bus to BART, to a bus to get to work, doesn't work for me. It takes an extra hour. So what's the solution, right? And for the time being, taking a TNC to BART and then a TNC to work saves me and makes it about the same as taking my personal vehicle. So think about what's not working and find a solution for it.
Great. Thanks, Jonathan.